Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. And I don't know about you, Ryan. I'm excited to talk about some economics.
Me too, because there's a lot going on. There's a new tax bill. The Treasury's up. The Fed might raise interest rates this year. They might keep them the same. We don't really know.
Yeah, there's a lot of balls in motion.
Like Elon has now left the White House. Now Doge's fate is uncertain. Are we going to get cut? Are we going to cut spending? Are we going to put the economy in the recession? Is this deficit a problem, right? And so, like, we need answers. So we went and found a chief economist to come on the show to talk to us pilots about what impacts does this stuff have on the airlines, your jobs, the market, real estate, interest rates, pretty much anything that you want to understand what's going on, we're going to dive into. And we're also going to teach too, because like, if you're like, what the heck's the Treasury? What does that matter? What do they mean when they say the 5-year or the 10-year, or what is the Fed funds rate and all that? We go through all that stuff.
Yeah, I know that this might be boring for some people. I love this stuff.
Yeah,
we're going to try and make it interesting and make it applicable. But listen to the end if you want to find out what the difference between the 10-year Treasury and all that stuff and the Fed. This stuff is important if you are, you know, we're all investors. We're all trying to deploy our capital in the most effective way possible. And I think this is a really good baseline education and just a finger on the pulse.
What I found was interesting was most of the reading and listening that I do to podcasts, they're all talking about our national deficit being this like massive problem.
Yep.
And it's spiraling out of control and we're not going to be able to service the debt and the Treasury is going to go up and that's going to impact everything and kick us into a recession. And I appreciated Peter kind of having a differing opinion for that. So
definitely,
I think that was going to be, for me, the most interesting part about this interview has been a different perspective on our national debt and how maybe it's not as big of a deal as we think. And so we want to hear it from a chief economist talking about it. So with that,
absolutely,
let's get to the show.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Peter, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I've been very, very excited to have you on the show for a long time. I am a bit of an economic nerd at heart, and I've listened to a lot of your podcasts on other shows. I have a deep respect for your work and what you've done, so very honored to have you with us here today.
Well, you're very kind to have me.
Do you want to jump in first and give folks a little bit of your background from your own words?
Sure. Blue-collar kid, blue-collar family, blue-collar city, first to go to university. Most of my siblings didn't go to university, end up getting a PhD at the University of Chicago many years ago, studying under Milton Friedman and a bunch of other Nobel Prize winners that I was fortunate to be blessed with. Teach at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton Business School for 30-some years. Retired from that about 15 years ago. I started Linnem & Associates, which is sort of a boutique advisory firm, finance, real estate, economics, 1979, continue to do that. We do some true advisory work. We do some investing work. We do opportunity zone investing. We do boutique investing, but we also advise a lot of major firms. Wrote the Blue Bible, they call it, which is kind of the textbook of the industry, real estate finance and investments, about 20-some years ago, and we keep updating it. Have a publication, Linnem & Letter, that just had its 25th year that has, I don't know, 1,000 major industry subscribers, family offices, REITs, private equity, et cetera, fairly pricey product. Served on probably 20 public boards over the years. Probably another 15 or so private company boards over the years. And try to stay apace of the linkage in the real world of economics and finance and business.
It's an amazing resume. Thank you.
Peter, one burning question that I think a lot of listeners have, and we want to kind of get into, you know, sort of where you see the economy headed in the next 12 to 18 months, but there's been a lot of discussion about our nation's debt and how the deficit of our country plays into what it does to the market. And the interplay between interest rates and real estate is a thing, and maybe how the bond market affects ultimately the interest rates that we put on real estate investments and how that drives where we put cash, how that drives our investment decisions. Certainly the tax bill has been criticized, the current tax bill that's going through has been criticized of not cutting enough. And my understanding is that there's some assumptions that the Congress Budget Office makes on what the interest rate might be for the economy, 3.6%. And with this lack of cutting our deficit, it might actually drive the bond market higher, which is going to mean more interest rate expense and effectively create the need for more debt at a time that our credit rating is down. And we sort of get into this like environment where I'm kind of nervous about interest rates going up later this year, potentially. Can you kind of unpack that or give your thoughts on maybe even just start high level, like what is the bond market? How does it play? And kind of talk us through, you know, your thoughts on that.
So, sure. It's very misunderstood. I think the basic narrative of the deficit and interest rates is basically wrong. The real simple is people think about the more I borrow, the greater the chance I won't be able to pay you back. Just think of it that simply, right? And they think of one of us. The more I borrow, the less I have cushion to be sure I pay you back, right? And therefore, people say, oh, gee, therefore, when we run deficits, we run a greater chance of not having the resources to pay it back.
Yeah, totally.
Okay. I mean, it's that simple. And when we believe that, the interest rate goes up to compensate for not getting, there's a chance you don't get your money back. All right. That's the simplest way I could explain it. The notion that the U.S. government isn't going to pay back all of the money they've borrowed in a timely basis with full interest rate is absurd. Of course they are. Of course they are. You have no doubt that the U.S. government will pay it back. And the bond downgradings on the U.S. government are theater. They're just theater. Is there really a higher chance that you're not going to get paid back in full? The answer is, of course not. If they have to print money, they'll print money. You will get paid back in full. And you will get paid back in a timely manner. I have no doubt of that. I have no doubt of that before any bond downgradings or after any bond downgrade. Now, by the way, if you said Argentina, do I believe that about Argentina? No, I don't believe it about Argentina. Do I believe it about Zimbabwe? No, I don't believe it about Zimbabwe. Why is it the case that we can pay it back? And that is, we have a lot of money. We have a lot of money. So our debt, federal debt, headline is about $34 trillion. But about $10 trillion of that $34 trillion is money that the government owes to themselves. Your right pocket owes to your left pocket, right? So any money paid out of the left pocket goes into your right pocket. You still have it. Okay, so it's an asset and a liability. It's an asset for your left pocket. It's a liability for your right pocket. They exactly neutralize. So when that's said and done, we have about $24 trillion. Now, GDP, which is a crude measure of our resources produced each year, our income, if you will, is $30 trillion. So think of your home. Could you pay off the debt on your home with 8 months of your income? I don't think so. We could pay off, if we wanted to, we could pay off all the outstanding federal debt with 8 months of income. I'm not saying we should or will. We could. I can't. Most people can't do that with their home mortgage, right? Their mortgage is $250,000 and their income is $110,000. It would take 2 or 3 years of income to do it, right? Very different. So first of all, we have a lot of income. Secondly, household wealth's about $164 trillion. 164. How much is federal debt? 24. Well, if I have a home that is worth $164,000 and I have $24,000 of debt on it, that's not a lot of debt to have on my home. And if I took that debt from $24,000 to $27,000, it's still not a lot of debt. And if I took it from $27,000 to $30,000, it's still not a lot of debt. Okay? It's not going to have a big impact.
What are your thoughts on, let's say, Ray Dalio's comments about, you know, how countries go broke and his big push to get the deficit down to 3% from 6%? What's your response to that?
Many levels of response. The issue is not the deficit. For us, very different from Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe is not rich. They can't do what I just said. They cannot do that, right? We're rich. We can't. If Elon Musk has a lot of debt, if Elon Musk has $50 billion in debt, for most of us, that's a disaster. You would agree?
Oh, yeah.
But on $400 billion or $500, whatever his number is, not so much debt, right? So things are relative. The real problem, and Dalio doesn't quite get it in my view, is are we getting our money's worth? Are we getting our money's worth? If every dollar the government spent was generating value, great, right? The problem is not the deficit. The problem is, are we getting value for our money? And people get confused. The minute you think the problem is the deficit, people right away say, well, let's raise taxes. Well, you know what happens when you raise taxes. You're reducing incentives to produce, which means you're going to shrink the economy a bit. How's that a solution? That's not a solution. By the way, if higher taxes got rid of deficits, how is it that France has taxes equal to 55% of the economy and they still have a deficit? So they raise taxes. We're at about, at a federal level, we're at about 19%. Okay. That is 19 cents out of every dollar the federal government's taking. Okay. Let's say we do what France did and we raise it to 55 cents. France and other countries would tell us we're still going to have a deficit. What's that tell you? It's not about taxes. It's not about deficits. It's about, are you getting your money's worth? Because if all we do is raise more tax, if we raise a dollar of tax revenue and we spend a dollar of five, we're not getting ahead. And that's our history, is that we outspend. And however much we raise, we spend more. Now, that's a political issue. That's not an economic issue. We're rich enough to pay it. I mean, a really rich person can afford to squander resources. A really poor person can't. We're really rich. We can afford to. That doesn't mean it's productive. And so people confuse the problem, which is not getting our money's worth, with the deficit. It's almost like a magician playing a sleight of hand. If I can get you to focus on the deficit, rather than we're not spending wisely, I've won, right? If I can get you to look over there instead of where the trick's really occurring, I've won as a magician. And it is a political magic act to get you to focus on the deficit instead of the spending.
Peter, you said getting your money's worth. In your mind, what does getting your money's worth mean?
Well, I know what it doesn't mean. Start out, this is take the old pornography. I know when I see it. I know building a bridge from nowhere to nowhere is not getting my money's worth, right? I know that, and I'm not saying that's all government does. Don't misunderstand. I know that taking money from you just to give it to me at a load, that's not terribly efficient, right? It just is transferring, right? It's not creating. It's just a load, transfer. What is efficient? And I'm just going to take a program, CARES 1, the original CARES Act. Was it perfect? No, but by government standards had a high getting our money's worth factor. Why? Nobody knew what was going to happen when we shut the world down. Nobody knew. And it could have been really bad. And what CARES 1 did, if you think about it, is all we did was borrow, right? And we borrowed to kind of keep people body and soul together, unemployment benefits, et cetera. Okay, hospitals, staying open, et cetera. Where did we borrow from? We borrowed from our future. That's all we did. We borrowed from our future. And historically, we're richer in the future than we are today. And I don't think anybody disputes that we're going to be richer 20 years from now than we are today. The fact that we borrowed some, spent some of it unwisely. Wait, do you think the mob collected money somehow on all the CARES bill? Of course, right? Well, you think there was some fraud? Of course. That's the cost of doing things, right? Unfortunately. But it was fairly effective. You could argue that what it was, Operation Warp Speed, was good, fairly efficient. But there's a lot of real inefficient spending out there. We all know it. We all know it. And there's not much incentive to get rid of the inefficiency. It's much easier to say, I have a friend, let's say, whose approach to life when it comes to spending is, the problem isn't how much I borrow. The problem is next year I'll earn more. And guess what happens next year? They don't earn more, but they spent more this year, right? If in fact, you are going to earn more next year, which is the history of the U.S. And we borrow from our future. There's nothing wrong with borrowing from your future. I would bet most of your listeners borrowed on their future income when they bought their home, when they bought their car. It's not immoral. There's nothing immoral about it. Now, if somebody with $100,000 income and $1 million in wealth buys a G5, I don't know if it's moral or immoral. It's stupid.
Right.
It's just dumb. Okay. So you want to stay in your limits. But the debt issue is very misunderstood. And I really do use this example, not just of France, but there are a lot of countries that raise taxes and they still have deficits.
So how do we bring this down to the street level for somebody listening to this who's an airline pilot? And you know, you're talking about how the deficit really isn't all that big of a deal. How do we understand this and make decisions based on it?
So fortunately, we live in the U.S. rather than Argentina or Zimbabwe. And the real truth is, at the street level, leave the fright house. Stop paying attention to this stuff. And I don't mean be oblivious. That's not what I'm saying. But don't get hung up on the interest rate is up 4%. 0.4%, down 0.3%. In life, that doesn't matter. Earn your money, live within your means, try to spend your money wisely. You know, you talk about inefficient spending, Ryan. You were talking about what's inefficient spending. Well, the private sector does inefficient spending too. Buying heroin, I don't think most of us would view as it's private, doesn't mean it was efficient from an economic point of view, right? My advice to the listener would be, tune out most of the noise. There's a lot of noise for political purposes. What's the line? If it bleeds, it leads. And, you know, Tate, you were saying how you're an economic nerd, so you don't want to read about the shooting. You want to read about the interest rate may go up and so forth. So take, for example, the current discussion about the tax bill. Okay. If we held this conversation 2 years ago, before we even knew the outcome of the election, way before the outcome, we didn't even know for sure if Biden was running and so forth. Would you have predicted that in 2026, 2027, 2028, we'll have pretty substantial federal deficits? Yeah, of course, right? You'd have looked at the deficits in the 4 years of Trump. You'd have looked at the deficits during the 4 years of Biden. Right. And you'd have said, I don't know quite who wins, but the deficits are going to be pretty high. And by the way, the economy will survive because we're rich enough to do some stupid spending and run bigger deficits. Thank God we're rich enough. It's not a surprise that we're going to have a deficit. It's not even a surprise about how big the deficit is. We could have had this conversation 2 years ago. We could have had this conversation 3.5 years ago. And we would have been very close to the predicting the same deficits they're saying today. Why is it getting more headline today? Because it frightens people. And they love it when you're frightened, because if you're frightened, you keep watching. And so my comment to people, real people, remember, I'm a blue collar kid, blue collar family, is leave the fright house.
Right.
Save the fright house for the week before Halloween. Don't stay it in it all the time. Focus on real things.
This is exactly what Ryan Holiday said. Fortunate enough to speak to him during a mastermind. And if you're not familiar with Ryan Holiday, check out his books. He's an amazing author. But you know, that was his comment. He wrote a book called Trust Me, I'm Lying. That's all about the economics of the news cycle, and pretty enlightening book. And that was his comment, is, yeah, turn the TV off.
You guys are smart. Do you disagree with my comment that we could have pretty much predicted what the deficit would have been in 2026, 27, 28, two and a half years ago, not knowing who's going to be the president and who's in Congress? We wouldn't have necessarily gotten the spending right, what they're spending on.
No, I think our country is spending more because every year our quality of life gets better. So the notion that government services aren't going to be cut, they're only going to be expanding. People expect more in some way or shape or fashion. I've read that, you know, 50% of Americans rely on the government for a paycheck. Either that's through direct employment through the federal government or through a private sector contractor. And if you don't think that applies to you as an airline pilot, like, who's in the back of your plane paying your ticket? Like, somebody going to a conference or a trade show or on a business trip, or that works for the government or works for a government contractor fulfilling a service. So yes, like, this economy thrives on the government spending money and going into deficit. I guess my question is like, you mentioned the $126 trillion wealth against the measly $27 or $24 million
trillion dollar
deficit. Trillion, yeah, millions would be great.
It's a shame they rhyme.
Yeah, yeah. Like, when is it? Like, because if this is continuing, you know, when you look out now, I mean, I know, turn the TV off, let's not be frightened, but when does it get to that point where maybe it is a problem and that the trajectory we're on is that it's going to continue growing and growing and growing? Do you see that 126 of trillion of wealth in America? Do you see that continuing to grow, like, proportionate?
Sure.
Or in locks?
Why do I believe that grows? That's one thing you would have gotten right almost all the time for the last 130 years, which is, come back 10 years from now and adjusting for inflation, will be richer. And you probably would have been wrong only an extended period of the 1930s through the end of World War II, which was an extraordinary period in history. Could it happen again? Yep. But why? Because we invent stuff. We innovate. The minute we stop innovating, by the way, I don't just mean new software. The minute we stop coming up with ways to do things better, cheaper, and faster, then I start worrying about the debt for the United States. Because if we cannot do things better, cheaper, and faster anymore, then sooner or later we will have a problem, exactly as Dalio or somebody would say. As long as we can do things better, cheaper, and faster, our debt is quite small, right, compared to our resources. That's a political problem, because it's real simple. We've got plenty of money with which to pay the debt, right? I took 30 trillion GDP, we only have 24 trillion in debt, right? I want you to pay it, and you want Tate to pay it, and you both want the pilots to pay it. And the pilots want the passengers to pay it. And you look at the senior citizens and they say, not me, I'm old. And you look at the students and say, not me, I'm young. You look at the farmers and say, not me, I'm a farmer. And you look at the tech people and they say, not me, we do tech. And everybody looks at everybody else and says, not me. And where that is a problem is a political problem. We have plenty of resources. Plenty of resources. We just all want to keep them for ourselves. And for example, I know one program that absolutely should never be cut, because in the history of mankind, it is the one program that is just, fair, and wonderful. And that's giving old people money. And as an old person, you can't take that away from me because I'm old, right? You can do anything else you want to all the young people. You can do anything you want to anybody else. Just don't screw with me. I'm joking, but that's kind of the attitude, right? And you know, don't tax capital gains, because I have capital gains. Well, don't tax income because I have income. Well, don't cap tax inheritance because I have inheritance. Don't. And part of the message, to be fair, is don't tax more. Get rid of some of the wasteful spending. And nobody wants to do that. I think you mentioned right. because of the political implications of that. Right. So it's a challenge. It's a challenge. I'm not saying it's when I say it's not a problem, it's not an economic problem. Big political problem.
That's interesting.
Peter, I want to switch gears from sort of the deficit and politics to the general economy. People have been seeing in the headlines, you know, I know headlines again, right? But people have been seeing in the headlines a lot lately about recession. Are we headed to a recession? So what are your, I know the crystal ball is probably real blurry right now because of all the uncertainty with tariffs and all of that. But where do you see us in the next 12 to 18 months?
I think we grow.
Do you think there's going to be a slowdown or
there
growth?
Might be a slowdown. In particular, the noise, for lack of a better phrase, around the tariffs, and you guys follow it fairly closely. I follow it fairly closely. If you say, where do the tariffs end up? I don't know. I know that tariffs are nothing more than a tax. And yep. I know that imports are about 10% of the economy. And if you do a big tax increase on any 10% of the economy, it will hurt the economy, right? It just will. I don't care what 10%. So if the tariffs shake out, that is not a big tax increase. It will have a small effect. If the tariffs that were talked about on, what was it, Redemption Day or Freedom Day or whatever?
Liberation Day.
Liberation. If they were introduced... I guess the old Catholic schoolboy is coming out in the Redemption Day, right? And sorry about that. If the tax increases that were the tariff increase, remember, tariffs are just taxes. If they'd have gone into effect, they would have knocked a percent or so off of GDP growth. There's no doubt.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think they'll go in effect. Even if they do, I think we would still get a percent or so of GDP growth over the next year. We're only in the fourth year of a recovery. Recoveries, remember how deep that recession or the drop was during COVID and the shutdown and all. And recoveries generally last 6 to 10 years. And we're in the fourth. You usually have big excesses in spending before there's a recession. We don't have big excesses in spending right now. So I don't see it happening. This is the third time in the last 5 years people have predicted, people, quote, the street has predicted recessions. And every time I said, I don't see it. I just don't see it. And I still don't see it. However, if we had big tax increases, whether they're in the form of tariffs or corporate taxes or whatever,
yep.
then I would change my tune. And it appears we're not going to get big tax increases out of the tax bill. It appears we're not going to get unbelievable tariff increases. We're going to get tariff increases, but we're not going to get unbelievable. So the economy will grow 1.5 to 2.25%. Is that spectacular? No, but it's not shrinking.
Well, good news for airline pilots, right? Because airlines are very cyclical and tied to the general economy and people spending and traveling and doing business and visiting friends. So that's good news paired with lower energy prices. I think that's good. That's overall good news for.
There is a wild card that affects pilots. And I know most pilots are more domestic than foreign. If you speak to people, particularly in Western Europe, they just don't want to come here this year. By the way, are they never going to come to the United States again? That's silly. Of course, they're going to come to the United States. But there is a sense of it's actually a bit ironic that the number of deportations done during the first four months of the Trump administration are lower than they were during Biden and they were during Trump the first time and they were during Obama. Right. The actual number of deportations are lower, but everybody abroad thinks they're going to get put in prison and deported if they try to come and holiday here. And you can have a long discussion as to why. So I think you are going to see decent travel from US to Europe, but I think you're not going to see a lot from Europe to the US over the coming months.
Yeah, because I know a lot of the airlines are already baking in a slower than usual summer travel schedule and they've cut forecast. Is that where it's coming from, you think? It's just more of a political positioning and what it looks like?
Yeah, and it's interesting. I have a lot of connectivity in Germany. And the only thing that hits their news is that if you come here, you're going to get thrown in prison the minute you arrive. And then they're going to keep you for a week. And then they're going to deport you. And, you know, by the way, the deportations that are occurring here are high visibility deportations, much higher visibility deportation in the first 4 months than the previous 12 years, including during Trump. So they're picking up on the visibility of it all. I have a friend when I was mentioning the lower deportation numbers and all, he had a comment. It's going to really be slow if we do it one legal case at a time, right? So,
yeah, exactly.
One court case at a time. But I do think that that is, for example, I think New York hotels, DC hotels are going to feel a bit because of European being down.
So this brings me to real estate and not necessarily the hospitality sector, but I'd like to kind of transition to, you know, we've talked about tariffs and the general economy and the bond market a little bit, but I'd love to talk about where you think we are in the commercial real estate cycle. Maybe a little bit of stocks versus real estate, friendly debate there. Because I mean, commercial real estate has been pretty beat up over the last few years because of the quick rise in interest rates during 21, 22. Where do you think we are in that cycle right now?
And Tate, I think you said it exactly correctly. It was the quick rise. Right. In interest. It wasn't the rise in interest rates that did it, because we've had periods where the interest rates have been there before and the market's done just fine. It was the speed at which it occurred, and that was the dislocation, because a lot of people got caught out in that. Look, let's ignore the office sector for a moment, and let's think of apartments, and what I'm going to say, apartments, rental apartments, think of warehouses, think of retail, shopping centers. Demand has been good for the last 2 or 3 years. There's been no notable decline in demand. What did happen was a spurt of supply that started about, I don't know, now almost 2 years ago. And so you had the same demand growth, but you had more than normal supply growth. And of course, that came on the heels of a period where you had above normal demand growth. And as we came out of the shutdown, we had above normal demand growth and below normal supply growth. So rents shot up. When that happened, a lot of supply started and it came online over the last year and a half to today. So you still had healthy demand. You just had beyond normal supply and rents softened. Occupancy softened. But it didn't soften because of a weakness in demand. It was all on the supply side. What's the good news? The good news is those supply pipelines have largely emptied, not totally, but have largely emptied. Why? Because once you saw rents going down and interest rates going up and high construction costs, new construction activity didn't stop, but it greatly slowed down. So now what you're moving into is a period over the next 2 years where you're going to have a shortfall of new supply relative to healthy demand, and you're going to see rents start to shoot back up again in those properties.
And I think this is so important, right? Because anybody who invested might maybe went into an apartment deal in 2022 that may not be doing all that well is thinking, well, I'm never going to invest in multifamily again. It's actually the complete opposite, right? I mean, you ended up mistiming the market if you were in that deal that you bought in 2022, and now you're in this period of higher vacancy, lower rents, lots more competition because there's just new buildings that have been delivered everywhere. But I think the multifamily, at least, construction supply pipeline is down 70% since its peak in 24.
Yeah. And on top of that, another thing happened, which is because of the quick increase in interest rates. And again, I stress it wasn't where the rates were.
Right.
It's how they got there. Right.
Right.
You you can get from point A to point B by either going a million miles an hour or 10 miles an hour. And when you go a million miles an hour, it's more dangerous, right? So I'm sure there's a pilot analogy there.
Yeah, exacerbated by the bait and switch of the Fed saying, we're not going to raise rates, inflation's transitory, and then they do the exact opposite. And they raise
rates. And then they jacked up. So not only did you have this supply phenomena, you had capital said, I don't know what the hell's going to happen. I'm going to sit on the sidelines. And we know there's a lot of cash sitting on the sideline. We know there's a lot of dry powder. We know that there are less than normal capital flows. How do we know that? There's way less than normal transaction volumes. Well, if I see transaction volumes below norm, I know there's less than normal capital available. If I see transaction volumes well above average, I know there's a lot of capital available. Okay. At the end of the day, yes, interest rates have an effect. You know what the main determinant of values are? How much money is trying to be invested? If not much money is trying to be invested, you will see values be restrained or reduced. And if you see a lot of money trying to be invested, values go up. And I use this as a, I've done a lot of research on this, but I'll give a real simple example. If I told you that by the end of business tomorrow, this is a Thursday afternoon, if by the end of business tomorrow, $30 billion has to be invested in Philadelphia apartments, or the CEO of every bank in the United States and the CEO of every private equity fund and REIT will be executed.
They're going to shoot up.
You have any doubt that the $30 billion would get invested in the next 18 or 37 hours? Of course. What will happen to the values? We still have the same number of apartment buildings, right? And if you put $30 billion more in there, the values are going to go up. They're going to go up really fast. Why? Money flowed. And if I told you you had to take $30 billion out, values are going to fall. And so what that fast rise in the interest rate did was wrong foot the capital markets. They went to the sidelines and they're only just now starting to come back. So if I go back to the listeners, this is a good time to get in. Why? Because more money is going to flow as things work their way through. And as more money flows, pricing will improve. And in the meantime, rent and occupancy is going to improve. Because supply is down or is coming down, right? And implicit in what I think, Tate, you said as you were introducing this topic is often when it looks on the surface, it's the worst time to invest.
Absolutely.
It generally is the best time to invest and vice versa, you know? And it's not 100% true, but it's got a lot of truth to it. So I think this is a good time, mainly because not everybody is saying it's a good time.
Right. You mentioned capital flows and the tailwinds that create those capital flows, right? You mentioned, all these CEOs are going to be executed. It made me think of 100% bonus depreciation coming back in this new tax bill. And if that gets signed into law, that is going to be a huge encouragement of deploying capital, right? Because if somebody can buy an apartment building and get this massive tax write-off or any other real estate asset for that matter, it incentivizes the investment back into real estate. So I'd love to get your thoughts on that and then also where you think interest rates are headed. Because along with Ryan, I'm concerned that if the wrong things materialize, that we could actually see a spike in interest rates, which would hit commercial real estate.
So I think you hit it. I can't add a lot to what you said, which is to the extent there are encouragements to invest, there'll be more investing. It won't happen overnight. But there will be. And the depreciation will work along the lines you're saying. Does that make everybody invest everything? Of course not, because those are not just unique to real estate. They're going to affect a lot of businesses and a lot of lines of business. As to interest rates, they're too high by a good margin, not too low. If you take the consumer price index and tomorrow the personal consumption expenditure index comes out, it will come out right around 2% inflation year over year. And CPI two weeks ago, was 2.3%. Right? That's not a high rate. However, it's misleadingly high. Why? There is a concept, and I'll stay with CPI as an example, that makes up 24% of all the price increases is a concept called owner equivalent rent. And to the audience, it is a fiction that says, how did the rent you pay yourself as a homeowner rise in the last year? I will repeat, how is the rent you're paying yourself increasing in the last year? Well, most of your listeners are going, what do you mean the rent I'm paying myself? That's an absurd. I don't pay it. I pay for eggs. I pay for cable TV. I pay for a plane ticket, but I don't pay rent to myself. 24% of what is measured in CPI reflects something that no one has ever paid for, nor ever will pay for. And it has, if you take out that one item, which no one buys, I'm not taking out eggs, I'm not taking out airline tickets, I'm only taking out the one thing for which no one pays, the inflation rate's about 1.4%. Now, that's not to say no item is rising more than 1.4%. If you've got an inflation rate around 2%, why do you have a 4.5% safe short-term interest rate? It's way too high. It should be 100 basis points, 1 percentage point over. So maybe it should be 3%. They've got it at 4.5.
Well, I have one poignant question here, and I think I'd love to get your take on this, Peter. We've seen over the last quarter or two the federal funds rate, which has come down by 100 basis point, 1%, and the 10-year treasury diverge, where the 10-year has shot up while the federal funds rate has come down. Can you speak to that? Because for anybody that doesn't know this, the Fed doesn't set your mortgage rate that you're paying on a home. That tracks with the 10-year treasury. Why are those two things diverging? And do you think that they will come back to more correlation soon?
I'm going to oversimplify an answer, okay? If you think about when they had the rate at 5.5%, short-term rate at 5.5%, since then, inflation has fallen by about 4 percentage points, okay? And they have reduced the interest rate by 1 percentage point. What did that do? That meant the return above inflation I get for doing nothing has actually risen, even though they have reduced the interest rate, because inflation has fallen by even more. That drives money into short term and out of long term. By the way, think about it. The treasury is a government risk either way. So the risk is the same. If the short term return went up dramatically, net of inflation, of course, people moved into that and out of the longer. Why take a longer term risk? And long term is less liquid. So you've seen the long term move up, particularly as the Fed has been hesitant to cut further. Now, I still think the Fed cuts about 100 basis points this year, about 1 percentage point this year. This time last year, I said the same thing. Everybody thought I was nuts. Turned out I was right. And all I was looking at was inflation, not including this owner equivalent nonsense relative to the interest rate, and looking at it saying, why would you have a 5.5% short-term rate if inflation's down to 2.5%? Well, now we're down to inflation being 1.5%. Why would you have 4.5%? So that's the reason I think they lower eventually. They remind the Fed. So that's why the long went up. Money moved out of the long end into the short end because I get the same credit with a better spread. Okay. And people say, well, why isn't the Fed cutting it more? And my analogy is we've all seen these like muscle movies where, you know, they're sweaty and they're fighting against bad guys, and in the Vin Diesel or somebody is the, and late in the movie, like the number two or three baddie gets killed by the good guy, one of the good guys, and they shoot him like 42 times, and they stand over the body and they keep shooting at him. And eventually Vin Diesel comes up and taps the person on the shoulder and says, I think they're dead. You know that scene? That's the Fed. Inflation is dead and they're still shooting it. And nobody has come up and tapped them on the shoulder and said, but it's already dead. And they're still shooting something that is largely dead.
So do you think they're overshooting? I mean, I think that's your answer, right? I mean, you
like three magazines worth.
Understood.
Interesting.
Well, that's good news for real estate investors,
right? Real quick, Peter, because like I think a lot of people, like when you say the Treasury and the Fed, some people might be like, I don't even know what he's talking about. What is the most simple explanation you can give of like, what is the Treasury? What are U.S. Treasuries? Why do they matter? What is the Fed? What is that rate? Why are they different?
Two things that make U.S. government debt interesting, uniquely interesting is a better way of putting it. One is what we said earlier. You know you're going to get paid back whatever they promised you. You can't say that about anything else. You really can't. By the way, you might get paid, like think of an apartment building if you're invested in it. You can't guarantee you'll get exactly what you think paid when you think it will be paid and exactly. You can't do that. You might say, I have a pretty good chance. I even have a chance of doing better, but you can't be sure you'll get paid. Can't be sure on Argentinian government debt. Can't be sure on a lot of countries. You can be sure you're going to get paid. That's a unique benchmark. It's a, you know you're going to get paid what they said they're going
to
pay you.
And to be clear, that's you're talking about treasury bonds.
Treasury.
So the U.S. government issuing debt.
U.S. government obligation. So that makes it unique in, among all assets. You know you're going to get paid. The second thing that makes it unique, not unique, but pretty close to unique, is there's more trading in those guaranteed payments than there is for Microsoft stock or Apple stock. There's, if you wanted to sell, I don't know, $1 billion worth of federal debt today, you can do it. You can do it really quick. There's an instant buyer pool, right? There's not an instant buyer pool for your apartment building. There's not even an instant buyer for $1 billion of Microsoft stock. It would take Goldman Sachs a little time to process it and so forth, right? So what makes the government debt uniquely interesting is you know you're going to get paid what they say. Doesn't mean it's a good investment. You just know you're going to get what they say. And the other is it's got better liquidity characteristics than any other investment. It's easier to buy, easier, meaning cheaper and faster than anything else to buy or sell. That's why we kind of look to it as an anchor and then go from. So, for example, how much more difficult is it to sell $100 million in an apartment building than it is to sell $100 million of U.S. treasuries, right? And you kind of go, well, selling $100 million of an apartment building will take 4 months versus 4 seconds. And you say, well, how much is that risk worth? And so it's a benchmark. It's a benchmark. I don't know enough about flying to know what the benchmarks are there, so I won't hazard a guess. But
I'm reading here that as of May of last year, $27 trillion market cap.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're talking about an ocean.
There's nothing like
an
that.
An ocean.
There's nothing like that. And by the way, this is, you talk about Tate being an economic nerd. Let's go back to the Great Depression. In the 1930s, there was no government debt. There was no net government debt. So if you wanted a guaranteed they're going to pay me, it didn't exist because up to that point, the government had not really run many deficits. So there wasn't much outstanding debt. So anybody who wanted a guarantee, I get my money as they tell me, you didn't have it. If there's one good thing of spending as much as we have and running huge deficits, one of the good things is, what'd you say it was? 27, whatever the number you said.
27 trillion, yeah.
It's a lot out there.
So before we wrap up, I want to make sure that Ryan's question got answered here, because what we're talking about is U.S. government issuing bonds or issuing debt.
That's the Treasury.
Yes, the Treasuries. That is a supply-demand market. The U.S. issues debt. People come and bid on it. Other countries, domestic buyers, you and I, could go and buy those treasuries, yep. right?
And the way you and I do it, by and large, just so people know, is you're in a money market fund and they're out there bidding for it. Or you're in a Vanguard government securities fund. Well, that's what they're buying. There's some of those bidders that are out there in those instruments on your behalf.
We have a few minutes left. I want to talk about the difference between treasury bonds and the Fed.
So the Fed is technically not a government branch. However, it's like wholly owned in every way except title. Any profits they make have to go to the federal government. Any losses they have to be shouldered by the U.S. government. Any net assets they have go to the U.S. government. Any liability net they have goes to the U.S. government. It's the U.S. government. It's an independent agency, but it's the U.S. government. And they regulate. People forget they have a large regulatory role on the banking system. And they decide how much money they would like to see created. They don't control that directly. They have levers that can help determine how much money circulates, but they don't literally determine it. And in fact, in the whatever 50 some years since I was a graduate student, the levers become less and less effective. And that's because there are just more things like money today than there used to be. There just are. Credit cards, right? People use credit cards like it's cash in a way, right? You just wave your little thing and it does. And,
right.
So their control over the money supply gets less and less all the time. So it's Milton Friedman once said the Fed trying to control the money supply, they believe they're driving a high-end sports car with high-performance tires in perfect weather conditions when, in fact, they're driving a beat-up jalopy with bald tires on ice in a snowstorm, okay? If that was at all true in the 1970s when he said it, it's even more so true now. They just have more difficulty. Any of us would. There's just more disconnects between the tools they have at their disposal and the creation of, don't think of it as even money, think of it as liquidity, right? There are more tools at the disposal of creating liquidity every day.
Well, Peter, we want to be respectful of your time. I could sit here and talk about this all day, but we might have to have you back on. For people that want to find out more about yourself, your work, maybe your newsletter, how do people get in touch with you or find out more?
So the simplest to find out about the wonder of me, which will keep you entertained for weeks and years on end, the simplest way is to go to Linneman Associates, Linneman Associates. You'll see all the things we do, including a charity in Africa that educates a lot of kids and clothes a lot of kids, feeds a lot of kids. But you'll find, and you'll also find links to podcasts like this that we've done or presentations we've done in the past. And you can just listen endlessly to the wonder of me.
That's wonderful. We'll link to that in the show notes.
Well, thanks so much, Peter.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for listening. Let's start a chat in the Facebook group, Passive Income Pilots. Join if you haven't already. Catch you on the next episode.